And I think a good starting point would be just to kind of kick around the idea was, did accountability actually exist before the GDPR? Because the GDPR quite clearly makes it explicit, doesn't it, in Article 5.2, saying Article 5.2 saying as a controller, you've got the you're accountable for demonstrating compliance with the above principles, in essence, in that kind of stuff. So was accountability there anyway before in the old law, in the 1998 Act, or even in the old directive, the 9546EC directive, was accountability there anyway, Phil? And as the GDPR just made it more explicit, and then from that, then springboard into, well, now we understand where it's come from and what it, well, understand that it's there, well, what does it actually mean?
Yeah, and that's interesting. If you don't mind dissertation now and have a look through it, because it's several years ago and it's all very rusty. But the principle of accountability was in the Younger report, if I'm not wrong, which was done in the 70s. So way back when you know, data protection was in its infancy, this whole notion of people processing data needing to be accountable for it was right there, written into it as one of the, I think Junger had 10 principles, didn't he? But accountability was one of it, was one of those. And we mentioned at the very start of the day the Convention 108, didn't we, and the OECD's data protection guidelines. And it was in there as well. So back, you know, move on 10 years, in the 80s, the OECD guidelines had a principle of accountability enshrined in that as well. So it is not, it shouldn't be a big surprise. Now, accountability was also featured in the Data Protection Act, but the ICO didn't seem to kind of rev it up, really. They didn't really highlight it, but it was definitely there. And I can't remember exactly where I could find it. But one of the sections does say that, you know, that there is this principle of accountability, and it isn't worded exactly like that. And that's there because the directive upon which the 98 Act was based also had a fairly explicit principle of accountability, much the same, actually, as we got in the GDPR. So the 84 Act didn't, because that was a British invention, which was kind of a bit kind of odd, but it that didn't have the principle of accountability in. But I think it seems to come as a bit of a surprise to people when the GDPR was first kind of published, the text of the GDPR were first published, that, you know, this principle of accountability was in there. Now, when I first kind of heard that there was a principle of accountability in there, I thought it would go and hoped it would go a lot further than it actually does. I hoped that records of processing activities was more than just, you know, a list of processing activities with some metadata around it. I hoped it would you know, put a legal responsibility on keeping much more detailed records that would, you know, demonstrate compliance to a much greater extent, audits, for instance, you know, and there's no requirement to do that.
No,
anyway,
no,
that's
sorry.
I was going to say that's my start. It's been there for a long time, is what I guess what I'm saying. And I think there are two things. There's this, the accountability principle, which is being able to demonstrate compliance with the data protection principles. But then there's also this principle of accountability, which is right throughout the GDPR and the Data Protection Act, that, you know, you are accountable, whether or not it's explicitly stated in, you know, a principle of accountability. But it's there, isn't it? You know, if you're doing DPA, if you're doing training, document it. If you're having policies and procedures, document them. And actually, the ICO is pulling this out more and more. The Data Sharing Code of Practice says it's good practice to have an agreement for data sharing, not a mandatory requirement. But it does say it is mandatory to write down that you've got an agreement in place. You don't have to have an agreement. You've got to have written down awareness of an agreement. So I think they're expanding it out a little bit in their accountability framework and how they're driving that forward in the new guidance.
I would fully agree. That's I've always thought, and I've always said, accountability was there for the very same reasons. Like I say, in certain parts, like I say, the OECD and Convention 108 is maybe more explicit than it was in the Data Protection Act. Unfortunately, I don't think people's got that kind of level of understanding previously. And then because partly maybe that the Data Protection Act 98 didn't appear to come across as heavily enforced, and whether things were missed, and whether that's then led to this concept of, heck, it's now explicit. And people are suddenly kind of waking up to the idea that it's something new, when you're kind of going, but it's never really new in that sense. It's always kind of been there in the progression of data protection from the early 70s through to where it is now. It might not have been explicit in the law saying you're accountable for doing this, But where it's in you're responsible, you must implement, you must demonstrate this and the other, that's still all accountability. So it certainly has been there. I just don't think it's been the focus that it's had or that it's needed until the GDPR has come along, unfortunately.
But it's quite a focus now. It's quite a feature.
More now, more now.
Yeah.
But
and I think it will be going forward as well.
No, absolutely. And the point I was trying to possibly get to was, if you'd actually done the Data Protection Act 1998 right, and you complied at that point fully, and you were able to demonstrate fully that you complied, and you kind of maybe took it from the base compliance to a bit more towards best practice compliance, then accountability and the measures of accountability, you're going to be used to. You're going to be kind of understanding and accepting. Whereas now, at the moment, when you're talking to some new clients, for example, and you're saying, well, we need to set this in place, we need to have a governance structure in place, we need to do bits and pieces, it's as if all that kind of history was never kind of picked up on previously. But now we're here. We've got we're within the GDPR. It's only explicit right through different parts of the GDPR. It does certainly mention it within Article 5.2, but you can certainly find evidence of explicit accountability elsewhere, not necessarily using the term accountability. So, yeah, let's move on to, well, what is accountability and what does it look like?
Well, to most people, I suppose, it's that accountability principle in Article 5.2, as you say, but also in Article 30 of the Records of Processing Activities. So again, I think that's a key feature, isn't it, of record keeping. This is one of the where we go first when we're doing an audit. If you can't show me you've got records of processing activities, how am I going to get my head around what it is you do? I wanted to kind of have show some tools that we've got. So these are kind of going off a little bit of a tangent. So yeah, the accountability principle is about demonstrating fairness, isn't it, lawfulness, security, minimization. And these tools don't inherently do that. I mean, you end up having to have stepped through that to get to using these tools. But let me just kind of share my screen and show you what it is I'm trying to talk about. Just 1 second. And I've got three or four things just to kind of, again, anyone can comment on them and talk through them. So within our information governance toolkit, we've got a kind of a universal spreadsheet containing, you know, what we would say were the registers you need to do record keeping for data protection compliance management. So, you know, you've got all these different spreadsheets, each one, you know, this is a list of documents that comprise, you know, your governance framework. So, you know, not all of them are, you know, this is an unpopulated template, so you know everyone's going to have a data protection compliance management policy, presumably, and potentially an information security management policy, and maybe a policy around the use of CCTV, and maybe a policy around recordings by tenants. Now they might all be folded into the 1.1, or they might all be standalone. But you know, a document master list is useful to know what you've got and what version it's at, and so on and so forth. And you know, same with procedures and registers and any kind of official guidance or standard operating instructions that you've given to your employees, or you know, if you're using standard contractual clauses or standard Article 28 contracts, and you'd add them into your document master list and you'd make them available to people. So that's kind of one of the sheets. These are what, you know, I probably would refer to as you know, information governance resources. This is all kind of just test data. Again, people sometimes don't quite understand what they're meant to be doing here. So we send it out full of finance data, examples, you know, and HR data, because people can understand those departmental pieces. So this doesn't relate to anybody other than just, you know, template stuff. Is that, I don't know if that's too small, let me zoom in a bit. So this is the, you know, the headings here are what's required under the Article 30. With a little bit of additional stuff, you know, it's useful to keep the lawful bases here, I think, although Article 30 doesn't require that. We've got two of these ROPAs, one to cater for Article 30, and one, if you're a processor, to cater for Article 32. So if you're a processor, you need to know which controllers you're processing for. So that's where you would record that in this ROPA. I'm never sure about the, as you well know, the usefulness of an information asset register, because it depends how granular it is and, you know, what's in it. But again, these are just some examples of what you may have, just to spark some thought process, in the people that are filling this in. So, you maybe break it down departments, but it depends what you're trying to achieve, because it's not a legal requirement to have an information asset register. Really, what you're trying to achieve by compiling one is what I always would say. And I don't interject at any time, Dave, if you want to clarify.
I was just thinking about maybe just putting a bit of clarity around the information asset register there, because I've certainly worked with some people that's got different opinions on what an information asset register is. And I know we've previously spoken about this. So some people working in maybe more of an IT background, the asset register then is a list of assets, maybe not classed as an information asset register, but certainly a list of assets. So what computers have you got? What's the serial numbers? What's the mobile phones? What are the tablets and bits and pieces? Having all those logged appropriately. So then when it comes to at the end of that life of that equipment, then you can show that it's been destroyed appropriately and information deleted in a secure manner, or the thing deleted in a secure manner or destroyed in a secure manner. So a lot of people coming from that kind of background thinks, well, an asset register is something that IT do with hardware and software. But then in a different environment, in a different set of circumstances, the information asset register comes from, in essence, like records management, where organizations use an asset register to log important documents. So it may well be contractual documents that they've got. It may well be the company's articles of association. So it demonstrates what they've got and where it is and who's got access to it and how long we keep it for from a records processing point, which is slightly different to doing kind of Europa and looking at Europa in essence of a processing activity, as opposed to an information asset register looking at information itself as an asset, and not necessarily just the equipment that it's sat on, as in like an IT asset register, if you want to kind of really split and define the terms out there. So I think sometimes people get confused with the terms and not necessarily being able to or necessarily needing some kind of assistance with kind of differentiating between what we're looking at. Now, arguably, you could have Europa and the information asset register that you got here. You could more or less combine them. So as long as you cover the requirements within Article 30, if you're a controller, then does it make a difference, really, whether you call it an information asset register or Europa?
Well, it doesn't, does it? I mean, if there's a legal requirement to keep a ROPA and you call it an IAR, it don't matter, does it? The legal requirement is not to call whatever you've got a ROPA, it's to keep the records within the ROPA. But I always get confused, if I'm being honest, with the information asset register, despite being an ISO 27001 lead auditor. I still get confused about what it is and what its purpose is and what to put on it. So in this example here, we've got lists of deleted users, lists of reported loss of equipment. These are all individual identified assets of information, information which have obviously got value to the business, which is why they're considered to be assets. But you can go down to nth degree, and having been through many compliance projects, blooming hard process to go through, isn't it?
It certainly is, because like you say, looking at the information assets, so you've got the asset is something that information sits on in this sense. But if you're looking at processing activities, again, records of processing could go to the nth degree if you think, and I know we've kind of kicked around before, the activity of walking or taking a document to the shredder could be classed as a processing activity because it's caught by the definition of processing. So do you represent that on Europa? Or do you just keep it at more of a kind of a what's the core function kind of level, as opposed to kind of a really granular level that everything's, I don't suppose you'll actually ever get everything on there, but to a real granular level.
Well, I think this is too detailed, all the stuff in here. I mean, it's there to try and prompt thought and discussion and illustrate differences. Like here we've got an Article 9 condition for processing, and there we've got an Article 6. So different ones. So we've kind of manipulated or artificially created this to give points of discussion, haven't we? But with all this stuff, I would say start with the big stuff, and incrementally you should either break stuff down or other stuff will fall out of the woodwork as you revisit this on a regular basis. So anyway, this spreadsheet here, I mean the one of the major drawbacks and bugbears I've got with spreadsheets is we've done projects with clients where because there's no control over what people put in here, you can put anything in here. There's no data validation, there's no control over the framework. So unless you apply it, people can slot in extra columns. So when you get them back from the departments who fill these things in, you got a whole hodgepodge of stuff you got to try and then make sense of sometimes. But anyway, in this kind of universal combined registers, we've also got a standalone retention schedule, which again, you know, arguably you could create that within here. You know, the retention schedule could be a feature of the ROPA because it's one of the requirements of a ROPA. But if you wanted to have a standalone retention schedule, maybe, you know, the ROPA is only for personal data, but the retention schedule is for other forms of information. So, you know, it could be that this register fulfills more than just data protection purposes. And that could be true of the IAR as well. So if you're a PCI compliant or required PCI compliance, you might add in a register of point of interaction devices, for instance, as well. So if you've got to keep it in one place is my philosophy. But obviously you've centralized your risk, and if the thing gets corrupted, you're fairly snookered then.
For sure, and I do like the decentralized approach where you've got a bit of granularity there, because if somebody exercised the right to be forgotten, for example, you've certainly got a place to start saying, well, can we delete this? What's lawful ground are we processing under? And it certainly gives you there as a evidential point of reference to say, well, we're processing under the contract, or we're processing because there's a public interest, or we're processing under legitimate interest. And it certainly enables giving effect to rights and understanding where the data is and what you can do with it in relation to what the lawful basis of processing is.
Yeah, we've played around with this many times. These were all when we first wrote our information governance toolkit, or rather when we revisited the information governance toolkit for the GDPR, because the first time we wrote it was in 2011. But when we redid it all, and Jason was substantially involved in doing this, we had different registers as different sheets. In fact, they were Word documents, not even spreadsheets. And what we found when we were deploying it is you just couldn't, or our customers couldn't keep track of them all. They had registered for this, that, and the next thing, and there was like 13 different documents. So we then thought it's a good idea to centralize it. You've got one place to go data protection compliance management. But, you know, again, with what we're now finding is you might have a ROPA that's like 10,000 rows long. And these things are starting to grow now, and you know, you're getting more DPIA registered and breaches registered and rights requests registered. So it's becoming a much bigger file, and potentially now more complicated to find things, and potentially now, you know, more prone to corruption, and potentially now, you know, Excel doesn't do multi-user very well. If you've got a shared spreadsheet and people are, you know, in it at the same time, it gets really confused. So there's more chance of, I mean, I love it for what it is, the simplicity of setting something up as a register. And I hate it for that as well, because people can manipulate it, change it, kill it, you know, and it falls over really quickly. And if you don't know, there's no audit trail, you don't know who's added each record unless you then start to add in metadata here. But if somebody edits it, then, you know, how far? So, you know, it's fine to get off the ground, you know, but, you know, here we've got a register of legitimate interest assessments that needs tidying up a bit, I think. A register of rights requests, a register of agreements. Again, this used to be a register of processes, but actually, you know, why we have a register of processes and the register of sharing agreements and the register of joint controllerships? My view is stick it all together in one register of agreements. You've got one place to go to then. Same, you know, audits we've got, and training records, I think, is the final sheet. Previous information, training records, final sheet. Again, most people don't use this because they keep the training records in an HR system. But this is always one that's open to some controversy as well, Dave, is a register of privacy information. So my take on this is you need to know what you got out there, what it's used for, when it's updated. So that would lead to suggest a register.
I would agree, because surely if you look at, well, what did you tell somebody at the point of data capture, then how would you know if you don't keep a log of what privacy notice was applicable at the time? Now, you may have on the database the date the record was created, for example, and you could maybe then tie that back to the log saying, well, the record on the CRM system was created in June 2020, and in June 2020, the privacy notice at that time was version 1, for example. And therefore you've got a greater idea, a greater understanding of what an individual signed up to. But if you don't keep that, then how do you know what you told them at the point of contact? And how do you know whether you've refreshed that information and if there's a fundamental change or a fundamental update to your privacy policy? How do you demonstrate that you've made an individual aware that the privacy policy has changed and it's been communicated to them unless you start keeping records of that?
Yeah. One of my bugbears with Excel is when you got like sheet eight on their data, XYZ. So a simple trick to kind of make it work better visually is to just hide the columns that are not relevant. Always leave a spare, but hide the ones that aren't relevant. And when I used to do database design a long time ago, I used to design databases in Excel, and you'd always have hidden rows up here where you had some of your code and data validation things and stuff like that. But this is a bad example, really, because usually I would curtail it at 200 rows or something and just hide the rest, because it's just better for people to use if it's narrowed down, isn't it?
Can you hide fields in a sense like you've done there if there's information in them?
Yeah, you just hide the rows. Yeah, just go into format, hide row, whatever it is, format, hide rows, it'll hide those rows. But equally, you can go down and straight to the bottom and then format hide rows, control Y to do it again. And all of a sudden your sheet is a lot smaller, a lot more manageable.
Because the purpose of really highlighting that, and thanks for kind of demonstrating how you do that, is because I've certainly seen personal data breaches where Excel forms had hidden fields that contained data because the Excel sheet was never considered in the light of, well, is there anything hidden in there that I need to unhide to see whether there's anything that shouldn't be shared or disclosed. If we are going through the point of hiding fields, it's good. It certainly makes it a more usable document. But if it's going to be subject to a subject access request, we ought to be just checking for hidden fields and hidden rows or columns to make sure that we're not going to inadvertently cause a subsequent data breach.
That's a good point. So this is one way of kind of keeping these various registers that are useful to keep, and over time the accumulation of data in here is useful for demonstrating accountability. That you are complying with the requirements of the GDPR, isn't it?
It doesn't
cover everything. So, sorry to cut across, but if the principle of minimization is something that's in Article 5.1, and then the accountability applies to that. How do you demonstrate minimization? Well, I think you probably would have to demonstrate that in your OPAs, wouldn't you, and your privacy information. So we are collecting this information to do that with it. So that's how you would demonstrate minimization.
For sure, and I think you could probably show that through your OPAs, because as you're detailing, for example, I don't know if we've got it on that line, on line three with finance payroll, does it have the different types of personal data in there, or has it just got contact details?
It goes over, so it says, well, what's the type of data subject? Where who the data subjects are,
because I've certainly seen some ROPAs or information asset registers where when it says, for example, payroll, what's process activity, well, the process activities for payroll, has it got personal data? Yes, then it lists the type of personal data, so it could be employee number, employee name, and it details it out. And at that point, if you've got that kind of granular level of detail, then you can start working the minimization in there, because you could certainly be querying fields that are in there that doesn't appear to be for the purpose of that activity, for example.
Yeah. Well, this model is categories of personal data, again, which is the bare minimum. But we've worked with clients where they've got such complicated processing that if you're going to go to that level of granularity, it's a massive undertaking to look at every data collection form and every data processing activity and determine which items of data, which fields of data weren't explicitly collected, but what about metadata, that are implicitly collected and connected to that processing activity? It's a huge undertaking.
For sure.
So we tend to start off by saying, take the categories of data, but if there's some particularly sensitive processing, then you might want to dig a bit deeper. So again, just kind of risk-based approach to it.
For sure. Yeah, for sure.
So that's that. And we kind of shipped that out with our IGF. I wanted to have a look at this as well. Now that I came across this the other day, this is a bit of software produced by a company called Sears, and it's a competitor to our software DataWise. And they have a free version of this, which I've signed up to, and you can manage subject access requests, for instance. And you know, it's all right, but it's all right, but occasionally falls over. No, it is good actually. I've used it a couple of times, and you can record some information in here. The subject access request stuff did work last week because I used it. Right, so you can create a new DPA. It's very basic. You know, you can just create the fact you've got. Just it's one step up from the spreadsheet in a way, because it's just high level information. But it's in a database, so it's more protected. You know, there's a backup of it. It's got proper multi-user capabilities. It knows who's changed which records. You can create a template. You know, you can do. So there's quite a few things it does do. It's all right, and there is a paid for version. It's something like £30 a month per user, and you are limited to the number of records you can process in the system on the basis of how much you're paying. So for instance, on the lowest tier, you can do 20 SARs I think a month, and so it kind of works out like that. Now I'm struggling to navigate this, but I had a look at it and I thought this is actually quite good. It's actually quite a good system. It's definitely in a way better than a spreadsheet. Of course, you can't manipulate the data model. I'm just trying to, I can't talk more than do two things at once, as I keep saying. So these are the things it does, manages cookie consent. It's all at very high level. It's got a few templates. You can put your policies in here. It's got, you know, a few other bits and bobs, a pecker audit. I'm not sure what that is. But you know, there are quite a few. When we first wrote DataWise 2010, there was nothing at all on the market for managing data protection compliance management. And when we first went, if you remember, Dave, went to the ICO conference in 2017, 16, we were exhibiting. Yeah. And we were the only people with privacy, you know, privacy management solutions. And then last year we went, there was about 25 stands, wasn't there?
Absolutely.
Half the conference was privacy tech. So there's quite a lot of solutions out there, and they do a much better job than a spreadsheet in that it's more robust, but then you can't manipulate it, you can't add new fields in and things of that nature. The one that I do know a lot about is our system, which I'll come on to, but this was produced by the CNIL some time ago, which again, it's a free software you can download to manage privacy impact assessments or DPAs. I'm in the process of downloading, but bandwidth is getting a hammering, so it's taken about 45 minutes because it's not actually installed on this computer. But you can get this tool and you can install on individual workstations. And as I say, it's free and it's in English, despite being produced by the CNIL. And it's actually really good. And what I liked about this when I reviewed it was it forces a DPA, or can force a DPA, into an approvals process. So, you know, people have filling in bits of this form that exists in the tool, and then it's going off somewhere else to a different user to approve it or to review it or to modify it. So it gives you a really good audit trail of how that DPA has been treated, which is a superb thing. So I'm a great fan of this tool, actually. I only downloaded the first time around, which was about 4 years ago, this standalone Windows version. So you lose a lot of the networked functionality. But again, it's a good tool to use. There's some good free stuff out there. And this is better than a spreadsheet because it's actually taking users through a process. You know, they're filling in boxes. They're identifying risks from you know, fields. And it's going into here. So whereas a spreadsheet is just a record, we've done a DPA, this is actually stepping you through the process. And forget about forms. This is the form. You know, this software creates the form. So again, that's well worth looking at, I think, if you're kind of wondering how to manage DPAs or privacy impact assessments or whatever. This here on the CNIL website is a good tool. We're kind of building on the functionality of our own system. Our own systems, you know, I think it's very good. We've built a lot of work, spent a lot of work working on rights requests. We've got a lot of process flow in the background. It's full of test data. We're doing a lot of testing on it, so apologies for that. But people, you know, will step through a process you know, from the creation right through to identifying exemptions, and it gets emailed out to people to interact with it, you know, to do information searches or whatever. And again, with it, because it's a database, the whole history of what's happened to this request is logged in the request history. This is not being processed, this was closed, refused. Again, this process is to take you through in is this a valid request and so on and so forth. So I'm not going to overly dwell on this because it takes me at least an hour to demonstrate how this works. But you basically work through the 10 different types of requests. We're going to build in other types of requests like the housing white paper. We're going to build in a kind of a FOIA, quasi FOIA request for this. But it takes you through a process and it can involve other people. But again, we built this, let's say 2011, you know, it's a good tool. It covers off things like IT assets and, you know, within IT asset or information asset, it can relate to records of processing activities. And because you got this kind of notion of relational database, a lot of the information's in there once and gets reused by the system. Step up from a spreadsheet, you lose flexibility. You can't rename these columns, for instance, or these tabs, but there's a place for doing anything you want to do. There's a DPIA, data agreements, audits, processing purposes. If you want to do vulnerability testing, log those. You know, the resources is a set of procedures and policies. We've got training. And currently, our DPIA piece in here is under risk management, and we're only doing some basic recording. But as I like the Kinnells tool so much, I'm going to change that around. So as you come into this, it says you're creating a risk register or doing a DPIA. If you're doing a DPIA, it doesn't step you through the process of doing the DPIA, it just records the fact you've done a DPIA. So in the summer, we're going to change this around and build out the functionality, much the same as the Kinnell have done, to actually step you through a DPIA process with the forms and the risks and the evaluation of everything. So the spreadsheets are good. There are some tools out there. The tools aren't cheap, some of them are free. Again, if we should probably do some digging about, Dave, and see what else there is available. But I just thought, you know, in terms of accountability, you know, the record keeping is at the heart of it. You know, where are you keeping the records? Is it in the SharePoint? You know, are they indexed, or is it in a database, or is it in a spreadsheet? So really, that's what we kind of wanted to show in that respect.
Yeah, one of the real good things I like about the software that you're kind of showing to help manage that is it's not just the risks that you, or the inherent risks that you've partly mentioned in relation to things like Excel, but as you know, compliance isn't just a tick box exercise. So you may have done a DPIA that needs reviewing at some point, or you may have some of the risk assessment that might need some other input somewhere, and you can certainly then use the tool as a bit of a management tool to kind of either set date parameters to say, well, actually at this point in time the DPIA needs reviewing, or at that point in time we're looking at developing this other structure to link in with this bit of software and a further DPIA, or this needs reviewing in that light. And you can then use it as kind of a memory aid and a project management tool as well to make sure that your compliance is maintained and goes along with you along your journey of developing something. And I certainly like it from that point of linking it to people within the organization and kind of basically setting tasks for them.
Yeah. I'm frustrated, actually. This isn't working because I did create some on a call the other day with one of our suppliers, and now it's saying it's not there. So that's a bit that is a bit irritating. But anyway, yeah, it's we actually at one point did have a proper like project management piece in DataWise, and it's still there. We just hidden it because it's really hard to use. You've got all these different you know, as you have with projects, you know, resources and budgets and all sorts of stuff you can attach to a project. And we thought it would be very useful for managing a compliance management project, but in actual fact, it was just way too complicated. But you know, because we built this on a proper database platform, so it's got the concept of time, it's got the concept of tasks, and you know, users who can be assigned tasks, and you know, it knows if they've been done or not because it's a database. And that's what you get with any database system that you don't get with Excel. Excel is a kind of a dormant record keeping system. A database can be active because you can set rules. You know, if this doesn't move past this stage within 2 hours, send out some alerts, which is what we do in breach management. And when we get into subject access requests, etc., it knows that there's only one calendar month that suggests a due date. And then as you get closer to the due date, it starts to get worried about it and it starts pinging out reminders to people. But again, it's horses for courses. If you've got basic record keeping requirements, then you know Excel sheets might do it. And if as you get more complicated or want to be more sophisticated, then I guess what we're saying is the tools available to do it.
For sure, it's just kind of automating some of that process because everybody's really, really busy. And if you've got the resources to have some kind of software tools to support you with that, it can certainly enable the completion of your documents by being able to electronically nudge somebody to completing it. So, for example, if I completed a DPIA and I needed your self-fill to kind of review that and sign it off, I could just send a link through the system to say this has been completed. Can you please sign it off within the next week or within the next 2 weeks? And it gives you all that intelligence to show that it's happened and trackability and everything around with that. And that's what I really like in addition to as a kind of a real progress step from Excel. I think, like you say, Excel's good. It's certainly got its place, but it's certainly got its faults and it's certainly got its fears with it as well, especially from after spending months putting the thing together that you then lose all that because a system being corrupted or otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, my vision of this is that this becomes, you know, this is our product. I'm not trying to sell our product. I don't do selling. But, you know, my vision for all of these things, it becomes your central repository. So if you want the activities is a report, really. You know, so, you know, I want to have a look at the ROPAs for this department. I want to be able to pick a report from the reporting templates and run it off. You know, and I want to be able to send it away, you know, to people. There's a ton of reports in here on a variety of different things. And there are in all these systems. So I want to get my asset registry out. Out it comes. And with all these reports, you can export to Excel. You know, if you want to do some manipulation, you just export all the data out into Excel and start doing pivot tables and pivot charts and so on and so forth. But again, because it's database, so I didn't mean to click that, then what you've also got is the ability to send scheduled reports out to people. So, you know, this rights request overview report, for instance, there's only six records in there. But again, this is the performance statistics that local authority clients are using for managing their FOIA activity. They just run the report off, you know, give it out to their senior management. So there's lots of benefits in having.
But you could schedule reports like that to run at particular times in the year that would then feature into or more or less produce, if you like, a report that might need to go to your audit and risk committee or it might go to board, for example. And it would certainly help with all that KPI reporting, surely.
Yeah, that's the plan. Again, in auditing, what I envisage is we send auditors out with kind of an audit checklist pre-populated in here. What we currently do is we do the audits kind of offline effectively and tag all the audit reports on this record. But we create actions, you know, non-compliances or recommendations get logged in here. So you can see this old stuff. You know, we created these test records back in 2016. So, you know, this is a non-compliance or a recognition, and, you know, you can see over time you get a rich history, which if you're trying to demonstrate compliance to the regulator who says you're not compliant, you know, having this kind of information at your fingertips is going to be, I think, tipping the balance. Anyway, enough of that. I'm not trying to sell. I'm just trying to illustrate what's available.
For sure. I was thinking more because of when you're operating as an external DPO for an organisation and you're asked to put together DPO reports that you know go to board or that you know go to the auditing risk committee and they're wanting a range of KPIs or performance statistics to help demonstrate to them that compliance is being managed in a particular way, then having that automated certainly saves all that kind of analysis you have to do yourself from pulling multiple Excel sheets. And if it's all in a system that you can build the KPIs into or from a reporting structure because it's a database in essence, and you can get that reporting structure, it certainly makes a role of a DPO easier because every month it produces the information you want, which you then just sync into a report. And from the role that I do for some of my clients, that would be a godsend as opposed to manipulating different files.
Well, you could theoretically do that in Excel if you wrote some macros and, you know, you maybe had a master sheet that was a separate sheet or maybe one of these sheets that was actually looking at specific summary cells in each of these sheets. You could compile and manage KPIs in that way. But again, Excel's great for a lot of stuff.
You're speaking French to me now, Phil. I don't understand Excel to that level. I thought macros was something similar to Costco.
Yes. Anyway. So he's 15-4.
In essence, just joking aside, the fact that you could automate it, yes, you may be able to do something similar to a greater or lesser degree in Excel. But for those who aren't Excel savvy and things, having a system that's got it as with all the functionality that comes with the database and things in between, I think it certainly adds a great deal of benefit to people in DPOs or in reporting functions to board and ARC, because it gives ease of retrieval of that information at your fingertips.
Yeah. Yes, right. So I don't know if there's anything else we need to talk about on what have we been talking about? Accountability.
Accountability.
Is there anything
yeah.
else? Any final points, any questions, anything in the chat? I don't think there is there?
For me, I think just going back to accountability, the whole premise of accountability is not the like we said, it's in different parts of the GDPR, it's in different parts of the law. It's been around for donkey's years and people are just slowly starting to wake up to it now. But in essence, what you're trying to do is build yourself a defensible position should something go wrong. So in essence, everything that you're doing is going to be your safety net. And can you demonstrate that your safety net is working? And can you demonstrate that if your safety net's got holes, that you're working to tighten up some of those holes? Because you certainly don't want to fall through those holes. Or you certainly don't want to set up a system where you can't demonstrate your compliance. And then you're finding yourself at some of the full force of the ICO, whether that's a range of enforcement actions up to the fines, but obviously not just using the fines as a carrot, as a stick, should I say. So what you're doing from accountability is actually kind of going, do we understand the law? Well, this is our interpretation of the law. This is what we think it means. This is how we demonstrate our compliance to that point. And if anything goes wrong, this is what we're seeking to rely on. So in essence, that's where this safety net kind of concept comes from. So to me, that accountability is making sure that you've got a defensible position, evidentially a defensible position should something go.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there's other things that you end up having to keep records of. So if you're going to make a decision about not appointing a data protection officer, for instance, that's another thing that the guidance says you need to document. So that has to again be stored somewhere that's accessible in case you ever get challenged on it. And not only that, you know, if you're going to periodically review that decision and test if it still stands, then you know that's got to be built into a calendar of audit, and that document's got to be pulled out and reviewed and, you know, version controlled and updated, and then next review date determined. So there are other records as well, which we haven't really mentioned, but you know, the whole kind of concept of accountability is, you know, what are we required to do, and can we demonstrate we've done it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now then, I feel like I've only been on this for an hour. It's been about 5.5 hours, hasn't it?
We're coming to the end of the 6 hour stint, but we did start at 24, so we can push on through if you want for a little bit, Phil.
How do you mean we started on 24?
We're doing a 24-hour round-the-clock data protection stint.
Right, well, we could do. I'm quite happy to do that. I'm not sure we'll keep everybody on, but at some point I want to go for some tea, but I have to be honest. But it's been a good day, actually. I've really enjoyed it. I mean, I can't believe we've been yakking on about all this stuff for nearly 6 hours. Doesn't seem like it. I mean, I know you had a bit of a break and had a snooze partway through, but, I mean, Miles and I have been stalwarts right through, haven't we, Miles?
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm surprised.
Thought you'd fallen asleep, Miles.
Pinching himself. So we're pretty much rounding up now. We did talk about why we're doing this, and the whole point, David, is, you know, you said in the very outset, you know, it's International Data. What did you decide it was, Privacy Day or Data Protection Day?
It's Data Protection Day in Europe, privacy elsewhere in the world, because it's been hijacked.
Hijacked by the Yanks. So it's it's today because it marks the anniversary, 40th, is it? Anniversary.
40th anniversary, yeah.
Of Convention 108 of the Council of Europe, which was a treaty that aimed to protect the rights to privacy of individuals. And it was really focused on cross-border flows, wasn't it? But that's why it's today, which is a bit of a shame, really, because it does land on Saturdays and Sundays sometimes. And much as I thoroughly enjoy doing this kind of stuff, I don't think we'd have much of an audience if we didn't on a Sunday.
No, absolutely. I think it's probably been less. I do appreciate the day, though, because people often talk about Blue Monday or something in January, or Blue Friday in January, because of coming out of Christmas, there's no lights and things. And I think people fail to look forward to Data Protection Day, because that would certainly brighten up January for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a shame that we did a little bit of coverage of what's in the news. Elizabeth Denham is staying for another 3 months. Her 5-year term is up end of July, but she's been asked to stay for three months.
Do you think she's done a good job?
a successor. I think she's done a great job, actually, yeah. I think she's done a good job. Why do I think that? I think she had a tricky time. I think Christopher Graham did an okay job. I think Elizabeth Denham has shown her teeth more. I think she's been more, I think, I get the sense, she's been more aggressive than Christopher Graham was. I think that she's overseen that transition to the GDPR. I think she's overseen that transition out of Europe, all of which is highly challenging. And I think they've written some good stuff. I think they've done some good stuff. So I think she's done a good job. But what do you think?
I think she has. And I think it certainly helps possibly with a Canadian background, because they've always been quite strict with privacy laws, haven't they, over in Canada. So that may have worked. That might have helped, because Christopher Graham and previously, it didn't seem as enforced as much. So I'd certainly like to think she's taken a mantle and done some good, certainly delivered some good work. But I'd also like to think that she's potentially set the standard moving forward, because I would like to think that it will continue to be pushed, it will continue to be enforced, and people can actually start seeking to rely on a regulator that's got some value. And that's no in any way kind of any detriment to Christopher Graham, but you often find your time talking to clients about how important it is to comply and the reasons for that, and then sometimes you seem to get output from the ICO that just waters that down a little bit.
It's like Doctor Who's, isn't it? You know, who's your favourite Doctor Who? Who's your favourite ICO? I mean, I thought Graham Thomas was I can't remember that he did anything particularly stunning. I think Christopher Graham did some good stuff, but I do think Elizabeth Denham has done taking it on a bit further. But it is like Doctor Who, isn't it? Is this the fifth one we'll have had?
Or is it I'm not up to Doctor Who, Phil, so I'm not quite sure how many we've had.
No, ICOs. Was it Elizabeth France, the first one? I can't remember now. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So anyway, she's sticking around for another few months while you extricate yourself from our business and take up your position down there as the ICO.
I'm going to put that on LinkedIn that I've been asked if I would take the role.
The ham roll. You're doing the lunch one, are you?
If I'd walk them in with the coffees and then come out quite quickly, because they're talking about something far more important.
So the ICO is picking up the baton again. We talked about this morning on ad tech. So again, that's going to have a big impact on data broking. Not quite sure how that's going to land. We talked about the new EDP guidelines on data breaches, which we thought was very good because it gives some good practical examples. We talked about some other stuff in the news, but that was quite an interesting session. We didn't have anybody on the surgeries we'd planned. We'd hoped that we'd have people coming on asking us questions, you know, and that hasn't really happened. But maybe, you know, this isn't the right forum for doing that. So anyway, we managed to fill the time in there because Ollie was very good at bringing in some cases from the support desk, and we yacked on about those for a while. Kathy did an excellent slot on subject tax requests, which I think that's the point at which we started the recordings. So that is available to kind of will be available to listen to. We talked a bit about guidance. Have you got a favourite guidance, Dave? What's your favourite piece of guidance?
I think my favourite bit of guidance at the moment is the accountability framework.
Really?
Yeah, I think because I think I just spend half my time telling kind of making sure that you've got, can you demonstrate and evidence what you've done, because you may need to seek to rely on that. And especially since one of my clients had quite a serious data breach. And what it showed there was actually the safety net caught them. So everything that was put in place worked as it should work. They had the ability to scale things up. They had the ability to act at speed when something seriously went wrong and have a proper incident management team and response plan put in place. And they were able to evidentially demonstrate to the ICO at the point of notifying them what went wrong, what they're going to do to put it right, the remedial steps moving forward, that there's a report on its way and bits and pieces. And I honestly believe that that not only demonstrates that the organisation is well run, the approach that they took and what they're able to demonstrate meant that they avoided any form of enforcement action from the ICO, to the point that they kind of looked at it and went, fair enough. They have gone as far as saying that they want to see the action plan and be updated when it's completed, which is fair enough. It was quite a serious incident. But there's no enforcement action from any regulatory action from the ICO. So that goes to show the value of the safety net. And I think from that point, the accountability framework for me just underpins the reason why we do this.
I think that will take more prominence, actually, the accountability framework, because I was talking earlier that the data sharing guidance that came out last week, or the week before, does reference accountability and the accountability framework quite a lot through it. So I think that's going to be a feature that they drive through. Ollie and I both thought that the new direct marketing code of practice, that 124-pager, is both of our favourites. We think it's really clear. We think it's really useful. We think it builds on the previous guidance and clarifies things like business-to-business, direct marketing by electronic mail, where it says consent isn't required. So these kind of things, and what's a corporate subscriber, these kind of things were just left hanging in the previous guidance. But this new guidance, which I have to say is still out for consultation, clarifies those kind of points. So we thought that was really good. Just picking up on your point on evidence and defensibility, I was interested looking at the ICO's enforcement notice on Marriott, the fine, that the fine was significantly less than it could have been because Marriott were able to point to a PCI compliance report on compliance, a PCI DSS report on compliance performed by a qualified security assessor, a QSA. They'd had two ROCs provided by QSH, which gave them a clean bill of health. And the ICO accepted that was a reasonable organizational measure. Again, I think really important to see where the ICO is coming from in that respect.
And that for me why the accountability framework works, because it gives you some guidance. It gives you the bits that the ICO will be looking for in that sense. And if you're a board member going, well, how do we do this? Or you've got somebody tasked with the job, well, how do we do this? It certainly gives some really good key bits to comply with, as well as underpinning that accountability is needed, because it could be your get out of jail card, quite frankly.
We talked about the still relevance of European guidance. You know, it's still ostensibly talking about the same law, interpreting it, and it's a lot of brains that are very good at this kind of stuff that have come together to write this guidance. So at the moment, pretty sure it's still good guidance. I mean, we picked out some guidance from other regulators. I mean, Ollie, you know, obviously likes the CNIL or their guidance. He can read all their stuff. And we highlighted non-official guidance like the Data Protection Network's legitimate interest, which we both thought is absolutely fabulous. It's the best guidance, better than the ICO's guidance by a mile.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I particularly like their guidance for legitimate interest, because with a little bit of tweaking, you can make it a public interest test as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So it doesn't take much to adapt it.
Yeah, it's good. We spent a bit of time. I think you joined us by then, talking through effectively the blog that Matthew wrote for us last week about the Data Protection Act and how it works with the UK GDPR, and a little bit about the PECA and a little bit about EU GDPR. But I think that was important to cover off, because the DPA does such a lot, doesn't it, with it implementing. And again, people get confused about this. The DPA implements the law enforcement directive, but it doesn't implement the GDPR, because the GDPR didn't need to be implemented in domestic law, because it was a regulation, whereas the directive has to be. So again, that's unless you know how European law works, again, that's not necessarily that obvious to you, is it? You'd think you'd go to the DPA to find out about data protection, as our clients have, which is why we put this as a feature in, because we had a lot of questions about it. We talked a bit about, and I'm not sure we really hit the nail on the head really with small businesses. I feel for small businesses, because they're as tight on resources. They haven't necessarily got the expertise. They're getting a right battering at the moment in some sectors. We did sort of drift back to the sector. We do a lot of work in housing, but really we were at this point, but we didn't get anybody on. We were trying to talk about, you know, small businesses like estate agencies and dental practices and you know, plumbers and maybe small marketing agencies. Marketing agencies is a good one, because they might have complex processing as a processor, and we're expecting them to do a lot. You know, they've got their own compliance to think about as a controller, as well as their own compliance to think about as a processor. And I'm not sure actually in the session we really got under the skin of that. But I mean, we did say we'd do some special work for the Chamber of Commerce, didn't we? So maybe that'll come out in a few weeks' time.
Maybe do another session when we can get maybe representatives to support us with what their understanding or their fear of data protection is, and then to work more closely with them in that sense. Because, like you say, the small businesses were caught, and they certainly need to have something to demonstrate what they're doing. But that may well just be at a lower level. But it's having that kind of in a simple and understandable format, especially where you're either a one or two man band or possibly. Maybe a few more than that, but only very small scale.
Yeah, even 100, you know, 100 people in an organization. I mean, the bigger you are, the more complicated you got, the more people you got to try and to marshal, haven't you? And then we finally talked a bit about accountability. We talked a bit about record keeping. We had a look at a few tools that are available. Some we know well, some we don't know at all well, some that work well, some that appear to have broken. But ultimately, a lot of people fall back on the spreadsheets, don't they, for keeping this type of stuff, which is fine. But you know, you've got to recognise the inherent risks of a spreadsheet, as we talked about. But accountability is more than just having a spreadsheet, isn't it? It's about baking into your culture everybody being responsible for data protection and looking for opportunities to improve your processing activities. I think, you know.
It is, yeah, I would agree. I think it's accountability mindset, isn't it? It's that kind of being able to demonstrate why you're doing something. You're responsible for it. So you're demonstrating responsibility, then you're demonstrating how you meet that requirement.
Yeah. Years ago, there was this kind of, do you remember, zero tolerance? It was used kind of crime, wasn't it, and policing. But I've banged on about zero tolerance for privacy for years. You know, everyone in the organisation should have zero tolerance for privacy shortcuts and for privacy non-compliances, so that each person is looking for ways of improving, as you would in a manufacturing environment. You're looking for improvements, continually improving the ways you're working. But that's what should happen. It's quite hard to get everybody there, isn't it? But if you can start thinking, I think, if you can start thinking concepts like that, zero tolerance, and start talking about it, and you know, continually improving, that's the start of a journey, isn't it? That's either going to drive a journey forward or it's going to start a journey off. But the first step is to start thinking in those terms, if you're not already, or getting your colleagues to think in those terms.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I often keep referring back to how health and safety was many years ago, because I think that went through a very similar move where I alluded to earlier that health and safety was just Bob's job. I'm not quite sure where Bob is in that sense. You had issues with it. But health and safety now, after all the time that it's come in and the seriousness that it's had, people are more aware of health and safety. People are more aware of risks at work for injury to individuals. And I think data protection will eventually go through a similar kind of process. I think it's certainly not helped with the 98 Act not really having a great deal of enforcement. So it's never really been a board level issue. It's never really been heavily pushed.
I mean, the fines regime was pathetic, wasn't it? Was it £500 maximum fine? Would you believe that the maximum fine of the DPA was £500 until 2012? Was it?
It was, yeah, and it's that kind of stuff where you're kind of going, well, if it's only £500, then really we'll just pay the £500.
Isn't it a wonder that nobody takes it seriously? You know, in the past, it's just pointless, isn't it?
Well, absolutely, and even under the DPA 98. And bits and pieces, that was 20 years old at the point that the GDPR came in. You know what I mean? And it's at the point of being 20 years old, it's either you've ignored the law for 20 years or you've just chosen not to be compliant. I think that's why some organisations at the moment appear to be kind of struggling. But because it was never enforced, it was never made an issue within organisations.
Yeah, I think standard corrected here. I think it was 5,000. I can't remember if it was 500 or 5,000. It had a five in it and it wasn't at the end. And it didn't have any notes on it. So even £5,000 is a fine, you know, pathetic. No wonder people did. But I mean, the health and safety law has been around for 60 years. I have to say, Dave, that all this Younger report and, you know, all those other government white papers on data protection started before the 73 Health and Safety Work Act. So data protection has been around as long, but just hasn't got the same traction, has it?
I've traced it back. I've not kind of done a family tree with data protection, but I've certainly traced it back to the early 60s with the Younger reports, and I think it's even into the late 1958s, possibly coming out of Germany and places like that, where there was conversations about privacy and data protection and things. So it's certainly been around for a long, long time. And if you look at some of the principles within the Younger report, they're still around now. And you can still trace some of the principles back to those fundamental ones from over 60 years ago.
Yeah, but it's interesting. The driver in those days was press intrusion, wasn't it? It was all those Profumo affair and all that kind of stuff was the driver then. To we need some protection. People's personality is protecting because of the intrusive press. That's what drove it in the early days.
And you had very little protection back in the early days as well. You certainly don't have the similar level of rights that you do now.
Well, none really. Anyway, listen, we've got to 1602. We've been talking for 6 hours pretty much non-stop about data protection, which I think is incredible, really. And it doesn't feel like it's been 6 hours, does it?
So I think it's a world first. You should be going out on LinkedIn saying it's a world first.
It's a world first for me, Dave. Probably. But anyway, I think we probably should draw to a close and see what's in the email traffic. Probably about 200 emails to get through, mostly from Dave Hendry winding me up about stuff. But I think it's been a good session. So I really appreciate you helping me out, and Miles for organising it, and Ollie for talking as well. Appreciate our customers and anybody else that's been
on. You cheeky thing. I just twigged that. I'm going to send you a load now.
I bet you have done. So appreciate the support from customers. I mean, some of it might be useful, some of it might not be useful. It's good to do something different on International Data Protection Day. We do run these sessions. We enjoy running them. So if there's things you want us to do, either closed internally with you and your organizations or sectors or, you know, whatever else, then we're delighted to kind of take that forward and do it. So big thank you to everyone. And thank you very much, Miles. I know you've put a lot of work into organising it and keeping us all on the straight and narrow. Also to Dave Hendry, Kathy, who's not here, for her contributions. Jason Ellis made some good contributions as well. So we're going to sign off. It's been a first for us to do a 6-hour WebEx on the International Data Protection Day. Hope it's been interesting and useful. Maybe sparked a thought. Thank you for being part of it, and have a great rest of the week. And